The Young Child and His World of Wonder. One October day, Helen Keller walked through the Fairchild Wildflower Garden in Connecticut with Mrs. B. Tappan, Fairchild, and Polly Thompson, Miss Keller's companion. Mrs. Fairchild wrote of this experience, which was published in Audubon Magazine, March and April 1961, in an article called Saving a Nature Paradise. The following is part of that article. Someone picked up a leaf, placed it in Helen's hand, and said, "This is a black oak leaf from the tree that towers above you." Helen's fingers touched it carefully and lovingly. "No," she said, "it is the leaf of the red oak." And she was right. The next thing she saw was a dogwood tree. She put her arms around it, feeling its rough bark, and said, "What a handsome dogwood, and how red the berries are." As we walked along the columbine ledge, she touched the tiny plants until she found the spleenwort in its cool crevice. And while we lingered there, she said, "I feel a cool air, a current coming from above. That must be why the ferns love this spot." In the many years that we with sight had walked this way, no one had ever seen what this wonderful person had shown us. How I wished that the well-remembered figure of Benjamin T. Fairchild in his rough boots, tweeds, and big hat could have been with us that day. Following her visit, Helen Keller wrote, "It was an unforgettable privilege to have Mrs. Fairchild conduct Polly Thompson and me through the garden mists and mellowing fruits last October. A stream of extraordinary delight set my pulses dancing as I drew deep breaths of fragrance from the fallen leaves and ferns, ripening apples, goldenrod, and the accumulated delicate scents lingering from last year's wildflowers. Out of all the enthusiastic moments I have heard and read on the Fairchild Garden, I was surprised, as always, to find scarcely a word about the frankincense and myrrh which nature so profusely lavishes upon them. 500 different kinds of aromas, I am told, have been distinguished in wild plants, and certainly those gardens enfold one with multitudinous aerial harmony of exquisite, restful odors. They send faith chiming through the mind that all is well with the world. As whiffs float around from pine, sweetbriar, and sweet pepper bush, one sense of individuality is quickened. As each person differs from another, so each flower has its own fragrance, and the miracle of creative variety goes on forever. Another instructive wonder of the garden, as we walked from the crater through the weeds, was the rich world open to my hands. The tall swaying grasses, ponds, asleep asleep after long hospitality to millions of flowers and bird folk and curious rock formation. The autumn colorings did not brighten for me, nor did bird wings flash, it is true, but the elms, the noble tulip tree with its fiddle-shaped leaves, and the rough-barked hickory trees were eloquent to my touch. Farther on, an immense cliff bristling with big cedars in the boulder section imparted to me a sense of indomitable life rending away obstacles. I could not reach their higher boughs, but they were commonant in my mind because they suggested soul wings that drew me out of the roots of dark silence. With artistic perceptiveness, Mrs. Fairchild crowded as many tangible aspects of the landscape as she could into my fingertips, not forgetting what seemed cool mist rounded into berries, suspended on trees, or trickling into mossy hollows. As we moved from the enchanting rock to the next, my satisfaction was enhanced by the unpredictable caprices of verdure, rock, and green grouping. Grounds formally laid out, however elegant, have ever irked me with a feeling of prescribed, mapped out life. Emerson's lines recurring to me with new meaning. Quote, nothing is quite beautiful alone. Nothing but is beautiful in the whole. And they define the fascination that enmeshes the Fairchild Garden. My hands rejoice in the happy vagaries of those sylvan acres held in check just enough to let each part radiate its own glory and heighten the effects of an ever-changing whole. Like love and goodness, beauty cannot be encompassed by a yardstick or a formula, for it is a law unto itself. I began with this account of Helen Keller's experience to show you how much can be perceived through other than the two main senses that we use in a place like Holden, the sight and the hearing. She experienced all of this with her other senses, which to me is just fantastic. Of course, they say that when you're denied any one sense, other senses take over and do the job in as best they can. It's like nerve endings. When they are destroyed, other nerves take over. They can be trained to take over the duties of those destroyed. A young child is in a magic world of exciting things all around him, which he constantly wants to explore. Since his experience is so limited, nothing is too basic or simple. The child's energetic approach to life, exploring everything, is rudimentary scientific activity. There is a basic motivation or drive in a child to know and interpret, and then to control and to understand. This natural curiosity becomes a search to investigate and an attempt to interpret. There is a need for children to learn to approach life with a scientific attitude. If this scientific approach is learned early, their lives will be richer, fuller, and more satisfying. Science should be discovery rather than memorization of facts. The adult or teacher who experiences a sincere delight in discovering things that are new and different in the world of nature will communicate this attitude to the children around him. If parents and teachers have a feeling of excitement and surprise in everything around, then they will develop the same vigor and understanding in their children. If they can share with their own interest in observing, their deep urge to probe and experiment in all fields of nature and science, then the adults and children can learn together and gain increased understanding and appreciation of the world around them. And I think the important thing here is that if the adult is excited and interested, he'll take the time and he'll allow the time that is necessary to become immersed in awe of what is going on around in nature. If the adult doesn't have this interest, they're so apt to just hurry the child along and not even stop to watch the ant carry a load much bigger than himself, or the bird building his nest. I read not long ago an account by Arthur Gordon out of a book called A Touch of Wonder, and it's called The Night the Stars Fell, which is an account of a father who really had an appreciation of what it takes to help awaken in the child a feeling of awe, develop a sense of values of what is important, what is to be appreciated. And I'm just going to take the time to read this because it's the essence of the attitude of what parents and teachers should have toward their children and toward their job of awakening awareness in their children. One summer night in a seaside cottage, a small boy felt himself lifted from bed. Dazed with sleep, he heard his mother murmur about the lateness of the hour and heard his father laugh. Then he was born in his father's arms with the swiftness of a dream down the porch steps and onto the beach. Overhead, the skies blazed with stars. "Watch," his father said. And incredibly, as he spoke, one of the stars moved. In a streak of golden fire, it flashed across the astonished heavens, and before the wonder of this could fade, another star leaped from its place, and then another, plunging toward the restless sea. "What is it?" the child whispered. "Shooting stars," his father said. "They come every year on certain nights in August, and I thought you'd like to see the show." That was all. Just an unexpected glimpse of something haunting and mysterious and beautiful. But back to bed, the child stared for a long time into the dark, wrapped with the knowledge that all around the quiet house the night was full of the silent music of the falling stars. Decades have passed, but I remember that night still because I was the fortunate 7-year-old whose father believed that a new experience was more important for a small boy than an unbroken night's sleep. No doubt in my childhood, I had the usual quota of playthings, but these are forgotten now. What I remember is the night the stars fell, the day we rode in a caboose, the time we tried to skin the alligator, the telegraph we made that really worked. And I remember the trophy table in the hall where we children were encouraged to exhibit things we had found, snake skins, seashells, flowers, arrowheads, anything unusual or beautiful. I remember the books left by my bed that pushed back my horizons and sometimes actually changed my life. Once Father gave me Zuleika Dobson, Max Beerbohm's classic story of undergraduate life at Oxford. I liked it and told him so. "Why don't you think about going there yourself?" he said casually. A few years later, with luck and a scholarship, I did. My father had, to a marvelous degree, the gift of opening doors for his children, of leading them into areas of splendid newness. This subtle art of adding dimensions to a child's world doesn't necessarily require a great deal of time. It simply involves doing things more often with our children instead of for them, or doing it to them. One woman I know keeps what she calls a why not notebook. And in it, she scribbles all sorts of offbeat and fascinating proposals. Why not take kids to the police headquarters and get their fingerprinted? Why not visit a farm and attempt to milk a cow? Why not arrange a ride on the tugboat? Why not follow the river dredge and hunt for fossilized shark's teeth? And so they do. And one day I asked her where she got her ideas. "Oh," she said, "I don't know. But when I was a child, I had this wonderful old ne'er-do uncle who," and she went on to tell about him. "He used to open doors for her, just as she is opening them for her own children now. Aside from our father, we had a remarkable aunt who was a genius at suggesting spur-of-the-moment plots to blow away the dust of daily drudgeries. Once I remember she arranged for us to ride a pony with a bit of a skittish. After being thrown 3 times, my brother protested tearfully that riding this particular animal is too difficult. If it were too easy, our aunt said serenely, it wouldn't be any fun." Just a casual phrase, but it sticks in my memory. And the easiest door to open for a child usually is one that leads to something you love yourself. All good teachers know this, and all good teachers know the ultimate reward, the marvelous moment when the spark you are breathing on bursts into a flame that henceforth will burn brightly on its own. At a United States Golf Association tournament a few years ago, a pigtailed 10-year-old played credibly in the Junior Girls Championship. "How long have you been interested in golf?" someone asked her. "Oh, I got it for my 9th birthday," she said. "You mean your father gave you a set of clubs?" "No," she said patiently, "he gave me golf." The possessor of a wonderful realm had wanted his child to share the magic kingdom. No doubt it took some time and effort, some patience, some mystical transference of enthusiasm, but what a reward for both of them. And it might just as well have been music, or astronomy, or chemistry, or collecting butterflies, and I might add it might just as well have been fishing. My husband was given the gift of fishing from his father. I unfortunately wasn't. And it just seems that children need to be given fishing when they're little. It's awfully hard to enthuse an adult to fish because they think in terms of the product and not the process. To a child, it can be the process of throwing out the line, and that's a pleasure. But with an adult, if they don't catch the fish, that's my attitude toward fishing. If I can't catch fish, you know, what's the point in just throwing out the line? But I know my husband lives through his childhood every time he goes out fishing, and he comes home completely skunked, doesn't catch a fish, but he's had a good day. He's just had fun throwing out that line and hoping and watching and seeing, I suppose, all the things like his dad had made him aware of, that there are lots of things you can do while you're fishing besides just throwing out the line. There's so many wonderful thoughts that just going out there by yourself. Sometimes I think maybe it's a good thing I don't fish, because I think one of the things he enjoys about fishing is just to be by himself with his thoughts. But he loves to fish, and he has given the gift of fishing to his 3 little girls. Of course, they've grown now, and they, in turn, are giving the gift of fishing to their children. Children are naturally inquisitive and love to try new things, but they cannot find these things by themselves. Someone must offer them the choices. Years ago, when the Quiz Kids were astonishing American radio audiences with their brilliance, a writer set out to discover what common denominators there were in the backgrounds of these extraordinary children. He found that some were from poor families, some from rich, some had been to superior schools, some had not. But in every case investigated, there was one parent, sometimes two, who shared enthusiasm with the child, who watched for areas of interest, who gave encouragement and praise for achievement, who made a game of searching out the answers to questions, who went out of his way to supply the tools of learning. No doubt the capacity for outstanding performance was already there, but it took the love and interest and companionship of a parent to bring it out. I know when our oldest girl, who was young, we bought her, my husband would stop and buy her a book every payday, which was twice a month, and they would read it together. And I thought that was such a great thing, and I asked him, how come? Well, he had never had books as a child. He had never read the children's literature, and so he was just catching up. But he was as enthusiastic about those children's books as she was, or as they were, because he read to them as they came along. And same way with the Book of Knowledge. We bought the Book of Knowledge. That was the children's encyclopedia in those days. And so every night, along with a story, a children's story, and it would be, and they'd usually take the volume of Book of Knowledge with with the children's poetry and things like that in it, read something out of there. And then they would read something out of the heavier stuff in the Book of Knowledge. Some new kind of thing that both of them were interested in, or all of them were interested in. So that was just a bedtime routine, a little bit of Book of Knowledge, a little poem maybe, and a story, and then there possibly a Bible story, but always their prayers, and it was all a little bedtime ritual. This was very precious because in those days he was an oil geologist and went out into the fields a lot and wasn't home maybe for a week at a time, but when he was home, he made it count as far as the children were concerned. But I think now, as they grew, then in second grade, our daughter, our oldest daughter, if we were talking about something at the table and we didn't know the answer, maybe it was a word we didn't know the definition of, or it was something that nobody seemed to know anything about, our oldest daughter just couldn't wait. She just said, "Would you excuse me from the table, please?" And off she'd go for either the dictionary or an encyclopedia where she'd find the answer. It was just that insatiable desire to know new things. And you might wonder, what did she make of it? Well, she teaches medicine at Johns Hopkins. And I just feel sure that it was this stimulating of the excitement of learning new things when she was a child, which whetted her appetite to always be searching out new facts and new ideas. Children aren't just naturally, recently, a neighbor of ours took his two small children to the mountains for a vacation. The very first morning, the children woke him at daybreak, clamoring to go exploring. Stifling in an impulse to send them back to bed, he struggled into his clothes and took them for a walk. At the end of a pond, they stopped to rest, and while they were sitting there quietly, a doe and her fawn came down to drink. I watched my youngsters' faces. He said, and suddenly it was as if they were seeing and feeling everything for the first time. The hush of the woods, the mist over the water, the grace and gentleness of those lovely creatures, and the kinship of all living things. If you haven't taken your children down to the Salt Lick and watched the deer come, do it and take your camera along and take some pictures of your children when they first see those.
Where is that?
That's right down behind Chalet 1. Mm-hmm. Kind of between Chalet 1 and where Chalet 2 used to be, which that was the one that burned down. But it's right back there, and the best time is early in the morning or late in the evening. But deer around here are very common to see, but they don't come right down through the village very often, thanks to Omar. Omar would not like them eating his flowers, I'm sure. It's simply an awareness of the beauty and harmony of existence. And I said to myself, remember this moment. Put it away carefully in your mind, because you may need to draw strength and comfort from it someday. Giving his children a new experience, the man also opened a door for himself. I have a friend, a psychiatrist, who says that basically there are two types of human beings: those who think of life as a privilege, and those who think of it as a problem. And the first type are enthusiastic, energetic, resistant to shock, responsive to challenge, and the other type is suspicious and hesitant and withholding and self-centered. To the first group, life is hopeful and exciting. To the second, it is a potential ambush. And he adds, Tell me what sort of childhood you have, and I can tell you which type you're likely to be. The real purpose, then, of trying to open doors for children is not to divert them or amuse them. It is to build eager, outgoing attitudes toward the demanding and complicated business of living. This surely is the most valuable legacy we can pass on to the next generation. Not money, not houses or heirlooms, but a capacity for wonder and gratitude, a sense of aliveness and joy. Why don't we work harder at it? Probably because, as Thoreau said, our lives are frittered away in detail, because there are times when we don't have the awareness or the selflessness or the energy. And yet, for those who care what becomes of our children, the challenge is always there. None of us meets it fully, but the opportunities come again and again. Many years have passed since that night in my life when the stars fell, but the earth still turns, and the sun still sets, and night still sweeps over the changeless sea. And next year, when August comes with its shooting stars, my son will be 7. That's sort of a long story, but I just thought it fit into this so beautifully, and I could never have told it as he did. We should investigate. We should investigate all of the potential resources we might have in our community, which we don't. We can't take Holden Village back there, but we do have parks and we have museums. One caution about museums, though: don't overdo it, because you can really kill the enthusiasm by, you know, just staying there too long. And we have to watch the child. When the child is tired, then I think it's time, or disinterested, that's the time to call a halt to it. But we can take them, if we can have a college campus, they have science departments, a lot of them have museums along with it, and it's quite easy to make an appointment to come and see the things, or find out when the best time would be to bring your child or your children from your class. I used to take when I had lab school at Augustana College, I would take the children down to the biology lab. One of the daddies of one of the children happened to be the head of the department, so he was very wonderful about showing everything to us. But the thing that fascinated them most was the skeleton. And they were just a little bit afraid of it, but yet, one by one, they got brave enough to touch it and found that they were bones. But one of them said, "Where did you catch it?" And then, of course, we had quite an interesting geology museum with all the dinosaur bones and what have you. Fossils, I should say. We, as the teachers and parents, should provide opportunities to stimulate children to find their own routes to discovery, to make intelligent guesses, and to speculate. It's not necessary for us to know all the answers. A method of approach will prove valuable, and the teachers can, and parents can experience the wonderful feeling of satisfaction which comes from having learned together with the children, or relearned it. When we relearn things, we learn things in a new light through their eyes. A method of approach toward an unfamiliar insect which a child has found might be to look at the size and the shape and the number of legs and the color and the resemblances to other insects known and how it moves. And then we might get an insect book and compare it to other insects and find out, what is an insect? Does this match? I remember one a little boy, his mother was telling me, and it happened to be our pastor's wife, said that I heard Brian screaming down on the basement. And I was up on second floor, and I just thought something terrible was happening. And I ran down there as fast as I could, and there he was, flat on his stomach, watching a bug. And he said, she said, "What's wrong, Brian?" She says, he said, "It does have three legs on each side, and it has two antennae, and it has three parts of the body, and it has two wings." It happened to be a day when we had been talking about insects at home, and he saw the relationship. And of course, this is part of developing intellect, to be able to see relationships, to take a basic concept and apply it to a new situation, and that's what he was doing. Joy in simple things and casual discovery in the immediate environment can be the highlight of the day's activities. For instance, just watching an ant carrying a load bigger than itself. Joy in simple things and casual discovery in the immediate environment can be the highlight of the day's activities. For instance, just watching an ant carrying a load bigger than itself, discovering tiny seeds which will become great plants, and listening to bird calls, feeling and smelling newly cut grass, or becoming aware of the sound of running water. If we, as we draw attention to these things, have a feeling of wonder, we will also catch something of this feeling. As one of my little four-year-olds, there was a path we always liked to take through the campus at different times of year, so we could see the changes that were taking place. And this was in the spring of the year, and the leaves were just as green as green. They were just fresh new leaves. And one of the little boys said to me, "Oh, Mrs. Edmund, look at these trees. They're all smiling at us." And when they say things like that, I think we should catch on to it and say, "Oh, I like the way you said that. I never thought of saying that before." But they are. They look like happy trees, don't they? And then if we encourage this unusual way of expression, the children will be encouraged to express themselves in the first way that comes to their mind, which is usually the most delightful. I remember one little boy came in on a snowy day, and he's so excited. He said, "I saw a little rabbit, and he was running so fast across the lawn, his little feet were just twinkling." Now, I had never thought of rabbit's feet twinkling, but how else, you know, what better way is there to describe it? Observing changes which take place can be done during casual walks along the same route at different times of year. The bare branches of an apple tree in the winter soon become transformed by blossoms, and then by bright green leaves, and later with beautiful red or yellow apples. And of course, I think if it's possible, they should be able to use their sense of smell and smelling the apples, and taste, and describing the taste as crunching and juicy, and all the ways they could describe the apple. We should encourage them to do this, because then they are crystallizing their sensations in their minds, and they'll be helped to remember these sensations. listening to bird calls and feeling the various kinds of barks on trees. Have you ever thought of having your child just put a piece of paper up against the bark of a tree and coloring it? Just color the impression and then take it off and see how interesting a pattern they get. Smelling the fragrances, especially after a rain, and sometimes being allowed to taste the fruit that grows on trees. If you live in orange country, taste the oranges. There's nothing quite so exciting as picking fruit from a tree and eating it right then, like ripe cherries or apricots, any kind of fruit. A visit to a pumpkin patch in October might yield a pumpkin for the classroom and a real investigation of how many seeds there are in there, and you can roast the seeds and put a little butter and salt on them and have a delicious snack. You can cook the pumpkin and make a pie or just some pumpkin pudding. One Halloween, some little children were sitting around coloring or drawing pumpkins or jack-o'-lanterns. And one of them made a purple jack-o'-lantern. And the child sitting next, he says, "There aren't any purple jack-o'-lanterns. You can't make a purple jack-o'-lantern." And not only did he make a purple jack-o'-lantern, but he put legs on it. And the little girl on the other side said, "Oh, yes, there are. I just saw one walk by the window." Everybody took it, you know. Of course, they all knew it was a tongue-in-cheek remark, but it helped that child to know that that jack-o'-lantern was acceptable. If it's purple and if it has legs, if that's his jack-o'-lantern, then that's the way he wants it. Okay. And children have the most wonderful way of coming to the rescue of someone who might be criticized. Children's senses are sharp and keenly perceptive. We should stimulate and preserve this sharpness by providing rich and varied opportunities for learning through direct experiences. And of course, this is Piaget's song and dance, is direct experiences. Experience the object. That's the way we begin. We can't be talking in terms of mental images. We need the real thing, and we should provide it when possible. Development in this field commences early in life with interest focused on the natural surroundings. Soon the children will be discovering new growth of plants, noting unusual cloud formations. Remember that cartoon of Charlie Brown's? I think it was, that very intellectual character, Schroeder. And Charlie were out there looking at the clouds, and Schroeder described it in the most ecstatic language. Oh, just beautiful words. And then he said, "What do you see, Charlie Brown?" Charlie Brown says, I was going to say I saw a ducky and a horsey, but I've changed my mind." And then we should, while we're exposing them to things, for instance, calling attention to the shrub that's just covered with blossoms and seeing if there is a fragrance, and then coming back to that shrub after the blossoms have been replaced by leaves. Through such experiences, children may begin to follow the wide path toward scientific discovery, because as he watches, wonders, studies, and questions, he is experiencing science as a part of everyday living. He gains an appreciation of God's world around him. He keeps alive the sense of wonder. He begins to understand the orderliness of the universe. He develops a method of thinking and finds answers to questions. Science learnings, therefore, should integrate with the child's daily experience or to himself as a person. the importance of keeping alive the sense of curiosity and of providing opportunities for exploration cannot be overemphasized. Thanksgiving season, of course, all holidays point up certain interests, but Thanksgiving season is the time to talk about the Horn of Plenty, God's providence in such abundance. This seems an appropriate time to emphasize thankfulness for our healthy bodies and our responsibility to keep our bodies healthy by eating the right kinds of food and realizing that these are the only bodies we're ever going to have and that nobody's responsible for it but us. And that's a good time to examine different kinds of fruits and vegetables and wonder at the different kinds of skins and peelings on the different kinds of fruits and how absolutely appropriate they are for the fruit. The banana, easy to hang on to and peel down, and with its kind of mushy texture but sweet and smooth. And then the orange. Isn't it wonderful that God put oily skins on oranges to keep the juices in? Otherwise, it'd just be dripping all over, even from the tree. And the apples, with their crunchiness and their all the seeds inside the apple, how many seeds could be produced, how many apples could be produced from the seeds of just one apple. And how different the peach is with its fuzzy skin and its one great big seed. These are things that children should be made aware of, to appreciate. I think it's wonderful to have a wonder table on in not only a classroom, but in a Sunday school classroom, and to talk about God's wonderful creation and His providence, His overabundance that He provides for us. And let them see how vegetables are changed when they're cooked, and let them get plenty of opportunity to eat vegetables. I think sometimes we introduce vegetables in the wrong way. If we would introduce them when they're raw and cold and crunchy and let them use a little cheese dip or something to enhance the taste of the vegetable, they won't get that really negative attitude toward, I don't like vegetables. But introduce vegetables in all different ways. And let them eat them raw if they'd rather have them raw than cooked. I know in my nursery school, I just didn't allow any sweets for snacks. That was just verboten. And the mothers knew this. If there was a birthday party, they would come with decorated, bread, open-faced sandwiches with peanut butter on it, or maybe some cheese. At Halloween time, we'd have the round bread, and the children would cover it with the orange cheese, and they'd make the faces with the raisins. And for ordinary snacks, we would, sometimes it would just be a cracker and milk, but other times we would vary it with raw things and fruits, raw fruits. A lot of times children will get a different attitude toward foods if they get it when other children seem to be enjoying it. I know one, we have a little nursery school in our church, and the director was telling me about what fun they had at Easter time. They had made their own breakfast, and they had scrambled eggs, and the children just loved it. And one of the mothers said, she says, my child ate scrambled eggs. She just wouldn't believe. She says she never touched them at home. And the next day, that same child came, and with a great big grin, and she says to her teacher, guess what I had for breakfast this morning? eggs. You see, it broke the barrier. She tasted them finally because her other friends were enjoying them and it was special and she had helped make them. So there are all, we shouldn't just give up and say, okay, have a piece of candy or have a sweet, have a cookie. Or we've got to have birthday cake, gooey birthday cakes in the middle of the morning, even if it does spoil their appetite for lunch. Now, there's no need for that. It's just our attitude, thinking that the children would have to have it. They can go home and have their birthday cake after they've finished their lunch. That's they should understand that we have anything sweet after we've eaten all the other things. And if they're never exposed to anything else, they're not going to expect it. Of course, grandmothers can undo some of those things, and grandfathers and neighbors can ply our children with sweets in the middle of the afternoon. But we as parents, I think, need to really take this seriously. Because in the first place, too much sugar is wrong for our bodies in general, and it's devastating to our teeth, right?
Yeah. Neighbors should pay the dental bills.
Yes, right. And I was visiting, I was shopping in a grocery store one day, and I was in the produce department, and a mother was in there with about three or four little preschoolers. I thought possibly she was running the carpool from the nursery school. I'm quite sure she was because they didn't look like brother and sister and they were all pretty much the same age. But while she was buying the groceries, her own produce, these kids were playing a game. One would point to the lettuce and say, above the ground. Another one point to carrots and say, below the ground. Apparently that day they had been talking about what grows above the ground, what grows below the ground. So here was a made-to-order laboratory where they could really play the game to the hilt. And this is great to help a child even enjoy a produce department in a grocery store simply because he's aware of differences in the vegetables. And if we talk about the differences in fruits, it's the same there. He can look at the orange and say, boy, that does have a nice oily skin, doesn't it? It's so round. And they have little bumps on the skin. And that's the stem end. Because I can see where the stem was. It just makes more interesting people out of our children. Because they are alert to the world around them. As another thing which might help is, or which might help children become aware, especially be able to go to a zoo with a little more alertness to and skills and observation. Talk about animals and the different kinds of feet they have. Now all the herbivorous animals have hoofs. They couldn't go out and catch other animals. All animals with claws are created that way so they can catch other animals. They're carnivorous. And then of course there are animals like us with paws, and that like bears that just eat anything. But then when the child goes to the zoo with this background, he can look with a new awareness at these animals and find out for himself. He doesn't have to just say, is that herbivorous, or not even be aware that there are herbivorous and carnivorous animals, but kind of just lump all the animals together instead of separating and say, that one is different. A camel has hoofs too, I see. He must not, he probably won't be interested in biting me. And a giraffe with that long neck. He's so different from the camel, but he has hoofs. So he must eat the same thing, same type of thing as a camel does. I notice he has teeth that nibble, the kind of nibbling teeth instead of big, sharp teeth like the lion or the tiger. I know we had a bulletin board with all these pictures of the animals on them, and had been talking about carnivorous, herbivorous, and omnivorous animals. 4-year-olds just throw those words around. They love them. And the next day, we came in and sat down at together time, and one of the little boys said, "Wouldn't it be funny if an elephant had claws?" And I said, "What else?" "Oh, if a tiger had hoofs." And the little girl next to me said, "And a pig had paws." And I said, "You know what you've done? You've made up a poem. Wouldn't it be funny if an elephant had claws, if a tiger had hoofs, and a pig had paws?" And we said that over and over again, and this little song evolved. "Wouldn't it be funny if an elephant had claws, if a tiger had hoofs, if a pig had paws? Oh my, oh me, what a mix-up it would be if a squirrel lived in the ocean and a seal lived in a tree." And eventually that became the song, the first song in my book, which is going to come out August 15th. It's called Let's Begin with a Song. And on the left-hand side is the song introducing the area of interest, which is animals in that case, and then on the second page, discussions about herbivorous, omnivorous, and carnivorous animals, and then a little game, a little animal game, and then a little animal art idea, and at the bottom, lists of books that would fit into this category. But you know, this kind of, and it was the children who really inspired this book, because time and again, like the smiling trees, I've incorporated that into one of the songs. And we also have a kite song, where we all pretended we were kites and closed our eyes, and then they came back and told about the trip they had. And one of them said, I said, "When you get back from your trip, just open your eyes and I'll know you're back." And so one by one, my eyes went up. Came up and I said, "Tell me about your trip." And one of the little girls said, "I saw some birds. I passed some birds." And I said, "Did you say anything to the birds?" "I just said, it's a beautiful day to fly." And that became a song. I don't have the words, and I never can get through a song, even one of my own songs, without referring to the words. But it developed right there. If I were a kite flying in the skies, when the way it started. And that's another song in the book. We as teachers should be prepared daily to provide rich, exciting discovery in our classroom. We shouldn't leave things to chance. Neither should we ignore the chance happenings. On the other hand, we must be responsive and capitalize on the occurrence and adjust our schedule to it. If we have decided we're going to have a certain schedule that day and somebody brings in a turtle, scrap your schedule. Get your turtle ideas out. And that you need some turtle, you need some to accumulate files of ideas, you need to accumulate files of poems, files of songs, files of pictures, files of stories, or indexes, so you know exactly where you can find the turtle stories if they bring a turtle in. The kind of teaching that capitalizes on the child's interest. And that's the kind that produces results. You can use your planned program tomorrow or some other time, maybe next week. But we need ideas at our fingertips if we're going to effectively capitalize on what a child might bring in any morning. And then I think every Sunday school room in early childhood should have a wonder table where the children can bring things, where the teacher can bring things. Here is a chance to talk about specifically about God's world and his abundant providence, their awareness of God the Creator. Usually that's where we start with the tiny child in September, is with God the Creator and the world around him. And I don't know any better way to establish a faith in God or a belief in God but through his creation and of course his love that they feel through the people around them. But starting with his creation, we can go from there and develop a whole curriculum, at least a quarter's curriculum, until the Christ child arrives at Christmas. Then we go, of course, into the Jesus story and why God sent his son and sort of thing. Do any of you have any ideas? As I've been talking, I've monopolized the whole time, but did things come to your mind as I was talking that might give others a good idea, or do you have questions?
I think your talk about different experiences in this one woman that had a Why Not book seemed like
yeah.
very interesting. Because I remember in our church a young family that they took their boys every place. I think there were 2 and 4, 3 and 5, something uh-huh. like that. And they just wanted them to experience all these different things. And to me that made so much sense that I just wanted to do that for our children because I felt that was...
Are you doing it here?
Trying to.
Yes. Because they're experiencing a different environment,
right.
A people environment, a different people environment, as right. well as a nature environment.
We took him up to see the sawmill now.
Yeah.
My little boy is only 2, but I took him to see the electricity, and he called that the electricity. You know,
sure.
It's hard to tell him about the generator
sure.
and everything.
Yeah, that's right.
He likes it, and we both, they have different interests, but... I think that why not go on a...
Well, sure, you have nothing to lose.
It's a little bit selfish because I like to do the things.
Well, it's not selfish because it's your enthusiasm that will really infect mm-hmm. them. I know when I was teaching the Narnia down here, on Monday, we always did something about food. We talked about God's, the whole week we talked about God's providence in different areas. And the first was the food, you see. And we'd go out and we'd talk about what these little chipmunks like to eat and what the deer enjoyed eating, what we like, how it grows up above the ground and below the ground, and that type of discussion. And then on Tuesday we'd talk about the water, and that's when we'd go up to the plant and see the water rushing and talk about how man has harnessed that mm-hmm. God's water power to generate electricity mm-hmm. that we can use. And we'd also try to get a fish to look at mm-hmm. and we'd examine the fish and the gills and the scales and what have you, the tail. And then we paper fold fishes that day. And we'd play with water and things that floated and things that sank. We'd separate them. We'd try them out and then we'd put the floating ones over here and the sinking ones over here. Just so many things about water that a child can be interested in, besides just splashing in it, you know, but the many uses that we make of water. And then on Wednesday we talk about the sunshine, and our gardener would dig up a plant, a wild plant, so that we could see the root and the stem and the flower, the leaves and the whole thing, to see how it had grown in the ground. And of course there are a lot of other aspects of sunshine too. I mean, just the warmth, just go out and feel the warmth of the sun, and to stand so we could see our shadows. We play shadow tag. And then on Thursdays we talk about air. And at that, one year we had Dr. Tweet here, who is just a fanatic on kites and things and model airplanes. He just left a couple of weeks ago. But he had all kinds of contests going with the kites and the airplanes. And he showed them how to make little helicopters and float them, and we made airplanes, and we talked about breathing, of course, and by taking a sponge and pushing it together, and so it will absorb the water in a tub. It kind of shows how the lungs work with all those little hollow places that suck in the air, you know. And then on Friday, we talk about homes and shelter.